considering. Kids in school used to mock him, making fun of his disease.
You knew him then?
Juan told me about it. I kind of wish he'd go to the doctor, get some help for himself, but he won't do it. He thinks Bibiana's all the help he needs.
I watched him, expecting more, but apparently he felt what he'd said should suffice.
He used the knife to mound the onions, then walked the blade through the pile, mincing them. He crossed to the stove. I waited as he tilted the skillet, watching a hunk of melting butter circle lazily. He tossed in the onions and peppers. Finally, he spoke up again.
How you know Jimmy Tate? I saw his picture in the papers.
He's a cop, he said, rendering the word with venom.
An ex-cop. From grade school. We were kids together in Santa Teresa a long time ago.
He's a snitch.
That's bullshit. L.A. County Sheriff's Department just fired the guy, and he turned around and sued. They're not going to hire him to do anything.
Luis turned, pointing at me with the knife.
Let me tell you something. Tate's got no business with us. He shows up, and I smell a snitch. Don't tell me bullshit. I know what I'm talking about.
I could feel myself hesitate, backing up a step. The idea of Tate undercover had crossed my mind, too. In the interview with Dolan and Santos, I'd asked twice if they had a man in, and both times they'd been non-responsive. Tate sued against the department, and his Tuesday night arrest might be part of his cover. If Luis was suspicious, then Raymond would be, too, and every move Tate made would be subject to scrutiny.
What's Raymond say?
He's checking out a source.
Well, that's good, I said. Then he can find out for sure, right?
My heart did a rat-a-tat-tat from fear. The possibility of a department leak was already a source of concern. If word trickled out about me, I was dead.
Luis retreated again. He sliced into the skin of a Mexican sausage and squeezed out the meat in a gesture surprisingly ominous.
Soon I could smell the chorizo sizzling away with the onions and peppers. Luis broke 8 eggs into a bowl with one hand, then whipped them into a froth with a fork. I didn't want to defend Jimmy Tate too vigorously because it might backfire. Somebody might begin to wonder what made me such an expert. Best not to protest too much when you're tampering with the truth. Besides, Tate's cover had to be deep, if indeed that's what was happening. Dolan and Santos were both aware of the need for secrecy. I let the subject drop. I had thought to probe for information about the fraud ring. Now I decided to bypass the quiz. All I needed was Luis turning his steely gaze on me.
We ate the omelet in silence. I'm forced to report it was one of the best I've ever eaten. The few bites I couldn't finish, I put down for the dog.
Pero snapped the eggs up in one bite with a jerk of his head that propelled food down his throat. After breakfast, Luis scrubbed the skillet. My job was to fold the plates and throw them in the trash.
What's the program for the day?
I take you to the chiropractor as soon as Raymond gets back.
How come we have to wait? Can't we do anything on our own?
Luis said nothing. I decided it wasn't wise to press.
Raymond didn't seem to trust him much more than he trusted me. At noon, Raymond and Bibiana returned to the apartment. Her face was haggard, the look she turned on me full of dread. She was signaling something, but I wasn't sure what. In contrast, Raymond's mood seemed expansive, though I noticed the twinkle of a tick in his blinking. Bibiana took her jacket off and tossed it on the couch. There was a band-aid across the crook of her right arm. Raymond grabbed her from behind in a bear hug, an odd hostility disguised as affection. He caught my look, which had touched on the band-aid, and glanced off.
She had a blood test. We're getting married as soon as the license comes through. 3 days, max.
Congratulations, I said weakly. Really, that's great.
Luis extended his hand. He and Raymond went through some complicated series of palm slaps and grips, signifying great gang joy at the nuptials of another. Bibiana's happiness was so overwhelming that she had to leave the room, a reaction not lost on the ever-vigilant Raymond. I could see the tick pick up, his mouth coming open, his neck jerking back. Luis broke out a couple of beers, ostensibly to celebrate. My guess was he hoped to head off one of Raymond's attacks.
Get her out here. Luis is going to get us some champagne. We'll drink a toast.
I'll be right back, I murmured, and went into the bedroom. Bibiana was sitting on the edge of the bed, her head in her hands. I sat down on the bed beside her, watching her without a word. What could I say? She was married to Jimmy Tate. There was no way she was going to end up married to Raymond, too. Finally, I said,
What are you going to do?
She looked at me bleakly.
Kill myself. Or kill him.
She reached out and took my hand, giving it a squeeze. I'll hang in, I said.
I know that, she replied.
Chapter 18. Luis parked the Ford in a small, weedy lot adjacent to a strip mall that had probably been built in the early 50s, judging by the architectural style, which was of the cinder block and glass brick variety. The chiropractor's office was located in a storefront, wedged between a barbecue joint and a barbershop. Dusty beige drapes covered the plate glass windows, protecting the interior from the curious stares of those passing on the street. Not that there was much to see inside. The walls were flat blue, lined with metal folding chairs. A television set in the corner ran a Spanish language tape extolling the virtues of the chiropractic arts. A tattered illustration on the wall, labeled Chart of the Eye, showed the split circles with radial divisions essential to iridiagnosis, by which one could accurately identify diabetes mellitus, typhoid, aortic regurgitation, and other alarming conditions. The floor was covered in marbled beige vinyl tiles, through which a damp mop had been trailed recently, leaving tracks of yesterday's dirt. A counter separated the reception area from the examining rooms in the rear. There were 16 people waiting to see Dr. Howard, and no magazines. One of the other patients was a fellow I thought I'd seen in Raymond's apartment the day I arrived. I filled out a rudimentary medical history, automatically printing the first three letters of Milhone before I caught myself, converting the I and L to the double O's of my current alias, Moore. The form itself took 2 minutes to complete, after which we all sat and looked at one another while two babies cried and 11 people smoked 34 cigarettes between them. The inhalation of passive smoke in conjunction with my boredom was enough to make me want to flee the premises. I checked my watch. I'd been sitting for an hour and a half. I didn't feel I should complain, since I was only there to cheat the insurance company. I imagined all the other people, blacks, Hispanics, the elderly, the weekend athletes, being variously cracked, pummeled, pounded, and popped into alignment in the back room while I awaited my turn. People coming out to pay for treatment did appear to be relieved. Their backs seemed straighter, shoulders squared. They moved with more energy, taking with them enormous jars of pills, which I assumed were expensive vitamins or calcium supplements. Many soft and crumpled dollar bills were passed over to the bilingual receptionist, a woman in her 40s, quite possibly the doctor's wife. When my turn came, I checked her name tag, but all it said was Martha. She walked me down a short corridor, past the open door of what must have been Dr. Howard's office. I caught a glimpse of a scarred oak desk covered with stacks of charts and small standing picture frames, probably showing him with loving family members, thus establishing his marital status and firmly declaring him off limits to women patients with designing minds. I was ushered into the adjoining examining room, noting with interest the door between the two rooms, which stood ajar. I could see through the doctor's office right back out into the hallway, where a passing patient turned and looked at me with curiosity. Martha opened a cabinet and removed a print smock that seemed to be made of two oblong cotton panels stitched together at the side and secured with elastic at the neck. "Take your shoes off and strip down to your panties," she said, handing me the gown. "He'll be with you in 10 minutes."
"Thanks. Could we close that other door?" I asked.
"Certainly." She moved through the doctor's office to the hall door, closing it as she went out. I could feel my fingers start to itch, My, my. All by myself, and the office records of a scofflaw, insurance-defrauding bonecracker not 10 feet away. I checked the door to the examining room, which had a thumb button on the knob, which I pressed, locking it. I stripped my clothes off in haste and pulled the gown over my head, then padded barefoot into the doctor's office, locking his door, too. The walls were so thin and so poorly constructed that it wasn't hard to run an auditory check of what was going on around me. I heard the doctor enter the room across the hall, greeting the patient by name as he closed the door behind him. Their murmurs were audible, though the content of the consultation was lost as he proceeded to his adjustment. I kept one ear cocked while I searched as thoroughly as I could in the 8 minutes allotted me, uncovering a drawerful of claims that were a cursory match to the insurance forms I'd seen at Raymond's. I heard the door across the hall come open, the doctor's voice growing more distant as he gave a few final words of counsel and advice. I closed the desk drawer and crossed rapidly to the office door, grabbed the knob and twisted. The button popped out. I was heading toward the examining room again when one of the little framed family photos on his desk caught my eye. I stopped and squinted, peering at a bridal photo of a young woman I could have sworn I'd seen before. I snatched up the double frame, quickly rearranging the remaining frames to conceal the sudden gap. I eased into the examining room and had just tucked the picture frame in the handbag I'd borrowed from Bibiana when I heard the doctor try the door. "Just a minute," I called. I popped the lock and opened the door for him with a sheepish smile. "Sorry," I said. "I didn't realize it was locked. Are you Dr. Howard?"
"That's right."
He came into the room, closing the door behind him. I resisted the impulse to shake hands with the man. It seemed inappropriate since I'd just burgled something from his desk. He was in his 60s, very clean-looking. He wore white pants and a white jacket with a snowy dress shirt underneath, starched shirt collar standing up so high it seemed to pleat his neck. His dark hair looked soft on top. His hairline was receding, which left him with a long expanse of unlined forehead. He had cold eyes, a mild brown, behind square tortoiseshell frames, a humorless mouth that turned down slightly at the corners. He managed a perfunctory smile with his lips while the rest of his face remained fixed. His gaze was intense, giving him the look of a man capable of seeing straight from his own felonious heart into mine. The fragrance of crushed spices wafted into the room behind him, some faded oriental blend of musk and sandalwood. He glanced at my chart.
"Miss Moore, what seems to be the trouble? Why don't you hop up on the table?"
"It's my neck," I said as I hiked myself onto the table. "I was in a little accident, and Raymond Maldonado suggested I have you check it." He crossed to a corner sink and washed his hands with a virulent-looking red liquid soap from a wall dispenser. The gaze he turned on me was brief, but sharply focused.
"You should have mentioned that to Martha. We'll need an X-ray," he said. "I'll have my assistant take it. You can come back here when you're done."
He moved to the door and held it open for me. Instinct told me to take my handbag, which I picked up and tucked under one arm, a gesture of distrust not lost on him.
"Your purse is safe, if you'd care to leave it," he said.
"It's no trouble," I murmured, not volunteering to put it back. I had visions of his searching it in my absence, discovering the photo I'd swiped before he arrived. My memory warbled a little tune, too faint to identify. I was certain I'd seen the woman in the picture, but I had no idea where. Barefoot, I followed him down the corridor to a makeshift X-ray laboratory, partitioned off by a few temporary plywood screens. The equipment looked like some I'd seen in a doctor's office when I was a kid, bulky and black, with a cone the size of a zoom lens. I imagined 1950s-style rays, thick and clunky, piercing my body in poorly calibrated doses. The assistant, a young guy with a cigarette bobbing in his mouth, took two views, a full spine and a close-up of the cervical vertebrae. I'm wary of unnecessary X-ray procedures, But again, since I was cheating, it was hard to protest. I returned to the examining room, where I had another long wait, this time sitting dutifully on the paper-covered table. For all I knew, Dr. Howard was observing me through a hidden peephole. He returned in due course, snapping the developed film onto a wall-mounted viewer. He explained patiently, in chiropractic terms, how misshapen my spine was. Happily, my neck wasn't broken, but almost every other part of my back was in want of improvement. He put me face down on the table and did something divine, crunching my bones in a manner that sounded like someone chewing ice. He prescribed a lengthy series of adjustments, writing out his diagnosis with a fountain pen. He was left-handed, wrist curving atop the sentences as he sketched out his recommendations. The pen made a scratching sound as it angled across the page. Even his writing looked expensive, I thought. California Fidelity was going to pay dearly for my ills.
"What's your relationship to Raymond?" he asked without looking up.
Something about the nonchalance of his tone sounded a note of caution. "I'm a friend of Bibiana's, his fiancée."
"Have you known her long?"
2 days, I said. "We did an overnight together in the Santa Teresa County Jail." The sharp gaze shifted, and I thought I detected a nearly imperceptible pursing of his lips. He disapproved of lowlifes like Bibiana and me. Probably Raymond Maldonado, too. "How long have you had your offices down here?" I asked.
"Since my license was reinstated," he said,
surprising me with his candor. Maybe I'd misjudged the man. He opened a drawer and took out a number of ink pens of various types and colors. He passed me a sheet of paper with a series of slots in the left-hand column.
"Sign each line with a different pen, rotating them randomly. We'll fill the dates in later when we go to bill your insurance company. Who's the carrier?"
"California Fidelity. I called the office up north, and they said they'd send the claim forms down."
"Good," he said. "And what sort of work do you normally do?"
"Waitress."
"Not good. I don't want you on your feet, and no lifting heavy trays. File for disability." "Nice to meet you," he said.
He snapped my chart shut, got up, and left the room. Half a minute later, I heard him entering the examining room next to mine. It was 2:55 by the time I left his office. The day was hot for late October, the air perfumed with the yeasty smell of warm exhaust fumes. The neighborhood we were in wasn't much of an improvement over the one where Raymond lived. As I approached the Ford, Luis leaned over and opened the car door. I slid into the front seat. Whatever Dr. Howard had done in the way of adjustments, my hangover was at least gone. I tilted my head this way and that, taking inventory of my neck. Not bad. No stiffness, no more aches or pains. The interior of the car smelled of fast food burgers and cold French fries. There was an empty milkshake container on the dashboard and a white paper bag sitting on the front seat. "Oh, goody, for me?" I asked. I peered into the bag, hunger rising suddenly. "Luis, there's nothing in here but trash."
"I thought you'd ate."
"You thought I'd ate?" I said pointedly. Luis seemed embarrassed.
"Eaten."
"Yeah, well, I eaten the same time you did, and I'm starving again." I revised my tone. There was no point in being a bitch about this. Isn't there any way we could stop and pick up some lunch for me on the way home? He started the car, checking the flow of traffic in the rearview mirror.
"Raymond said come back as soon as you got done. We got work to do."
"How come we have to do everything he says?" Luis turned a flat look on me. I thought about Raymond's temper.
"Good point," I said.
When we got back to the apartment, the dog was tied to the railing out on the balcony, and the apartment door was standing open. There were 6 or 8 young Hispanics on the premises, most of whom I hadn't seen before. Bibiana sat on the couch, bending over a game of solitaire, which she'd laid out on the coffee table. Luis went into the kitchen and fetched himself a beer. I excused myself with a murmur and went into my room, where I removed the stolen pictures from my handbag. I moved over to the window and opened it quietly. The frame was a bifold, two photographs in matte gold hinged in the middle. I dismantled the frame and tossed it out the window, checking first to make sure I wouldn't be clunking anybody in the head with it. I studied both photographs closely, holding them up to the light. These were formal wedding portraits. The first was one of those group shots taken at the church altar afterward, people lined up in a semicircle with the bride and groom in the center. In addition to the newlyweds, there were six young women in lavender, fanning out to the left, and six guys in gray tuxedos with lavender cummerbunds on the right. Dr. Howard was clearly the father of the bride, whose mother didn't look a thing like the receptionist. I'd guessed wrong there. The second photograph was a full-length shot of the bride herself. She was the woman I thought I recognized. She was standing in three-quarter profile, her eyes lifted solemnly toward the stained-glass window above her head, bridal bouquet held at her waist. The dress was a close-fitting satin, with a train that had been spread out around her feet as if the material had melted to form a pool. Her blonde hair was pulled back, secured in some kind of netting like a bridal snood. The face was tantalizing. Not pretty by any stretch, but she'd clearly hired a team of makeup experts to enhance her every feature. I was sure I'd seen her recently, but not looking nearly as good as this. I squinted, perplexed. It was like seeing your mailman at a cocktail party in fancy dress. I had to shrug and forget it for the moment. It would come to me, probably popping into my head when I was in the middle of something else. I crossed to the closet, slid the door back, and pulled up a corner of the dark blue shag wall-to-wall carpet. I slipped the picture under it and pressed the carpet back in place. I returned to the living room, where Bibiana was studying the run of solitaire she'd laid out. I settled into the chair. I tucked my feet up under me and watched Bibiana play, keeping a discreet eye on the gangbangers who had formed a rough line near the kitchenette. It must have been payday. Raymond sat at the table, collecting handheld slips of paper, counting out bills in return. He was all business, conducting transactions in Spanish. Without appearing to pay much attention, I took note of the faces, wondering if I'd be able to identify them later from mugshots, if required. The only two I recognized were Raymond's brother Juan and the sulky fellow Tomas, who'd had so much trouble with his paperwork the day I arrived. Raymond glanced over at me, and I dropped my gaze to the solitaire laid out on the table. I'd watched her set it up so many times by now, I was almost ready to try it myself. This one wasn't the usual red queen on a black king strategy, but ran in suits, so that if you won, you ended up with only four piles, one for each suit, cards in numerical order from aces up to kings. She went through all the cards in her hand by threes without coming up with a play. She tossed the hand in and pulled the cards together in a pile. "You want to do my chart?" I asked. She shook her head. "The stuff's at my mother's, and Raymond won't let me talk to her. I tried to call her last night, but he caught me with the phone and nearly beat the shit out of me. What an ass!" She glanced over at Raymond, who had stopped what he was doing so he could stare at her. Bibiana stirred uneasily and glanced at me. She said, "I can read your palm instead. Put your hands on the table." "Palm down?" "Yeah, just put 'em down on the tabletop." I eased my feet out from under me and leaned forward so I could rest my palms flat on the table as instructed. Raymond must have realized she was into her palmistry, and he went back to work. Bibiana's look became intent. She scrutinized the backs of my hands, then lifted both and turned them over. She took my right hand in hers and examined it with care, saying nothing. Her manner was as professional as a doctor's. I don't believe in palmistry, any more than I believe in numerology, astrology, the Easter Bunny, or the Tooth Fairy. But there was something in her expression that piqued my curiosity. "What?" I said. She ran an index finger across my right palm, took up my left palm, and looked at it again. "You like action. You know how I know that? When you put your hands down on the table, you left a lot of space between. Insecure people put them close together. Short nails indicate you're aggressive. No ridges or spots, which is good. Means you're healthy. Skin type is medium, doesn't say much, but look at this. How wide the space is between your thumb and the fingers on this hand. You think for yourself. Her voice was hypnotic, and I found myself listening to her with great seriousness. I'd expected a lot of talk about lifelines and love lines, but she didn't have a chance to get to that. The trouble broke out so suddenly, I never knew what started it. I heard a shout, the banging as a chair fell over backward. By the time I looked up, Raymond had Tomas down on the floor. He was clutching the guy by the throat, the switchblade against his cheek. Raymond's face was contorted by rage, his hands shaking as he squeezed his fingers into Tomas's windpipe. Tomas was burbling, his eyes wide as he struggled to free himself. Sweat had beaded his forehead. I saw the blade of the knife slip into his cheek, sinking into the flesh, blood welling up. Raymond seemed almost hypnotized by the process. No one else made a move. It seemed to be one of those moments where retaliatory violence would only jeopardize Tomas's chance of survival. Bibiana whispered, "My God!" She crossed the room, kneeling beside Raymond, where she began to murmur in his ear. I could see him struggle for control. He made a sound like a sob, very tight and ancient, almost a squealing at the back of his throat. Bibiana touched his hand, talking to him earnestly.
"Don't do this, Raymond, I beg you. Let him go. He didn't mean nothing by it. You're hurting him. Please."
He lifted the knife. Bibiana extracted it from his hand while his victim rolled away, blood pouring down his face. Raymond seemed to cough, and his rage shifted from Tomas to Bibiana. He grabbed her by the arms and hauled her upright, shoving her up against the wall so hard her head banged a piece of plaster loose. He put his face an inch away from hers, the now familiar ripple of ticks tugging half the muscles in his face. His eyes rolled up in his head so that he seemed to look at her with the milky blind slits. His voice was a whisper.
"I'll kill you, you ever interfere with me again. You got that?"
Bibiana nodded frantically.
"I won't. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to."
He stepped away. The ritual cough and bark began, and I could see him jerk his head, rolling his shoulder in its socket. Louise had grabbed a kitchen towel and was pressing it against the cut in Tomas's cheek, issuing orders in Spanish. Blood soaked through instantly. Two of the guys came to Tomas's assistance, helping him out the door. The apartment cleared rapidly. My heart was pounding. Bibiana sank down on the couch, white-faced. She put her head between her knees, close to fainting. I moved over and sat down beside her, patting her and murmuring words of encouragement, as much for my own benefit as for hers. Moments later, Louise returned. I gathered that someone was taking Tomas off to the emergency room. In the meantime, Raymond seemed to have regained control. Bibiana composed herself and picked up her cards again with shaking hands. Louise wiped blood off the kitchen floor. All of us understood how important it was to get past the moment. To avoid any further upset, we acted as if nothing had happened, which made us co-conspirators. No reference was made to Tomas or what he'd done to precipitate Raymond's reaction. Raymond paced the room, snapping his fingers restlessly as he turned to Bibiana.
"Hey, get your jacket. We're going out. Hannah, you too."
I got my jacket. Hell, I wasn't going to argue with the man. This time Raymond and I took the Ford, while Louise followed us in the Cadillac, Bibiana in the passenger seat. I turned halfway, looking through the back window at the caddy, which kept pace with us. Louise and Bibiana were only dark silhouettes. "How come she always goes with him on these runs?"
"We fight," he said.
I studied him with interest. He seemed relaxed, his manner open and easy. I was beginning to understand that for a short period of time just after an attack, he was really rather benign, as if soothed by the outburst. For a brief interlude, he would be completely approachable, even loving. He was not a bad-looking guy. He could probably find a woman who'd care for him if he wasn't fixated on Bibiana. He caught my look.
"What are you looking at?"
His words were belligerent, but the tone was mild. "I was just trying to figure out why you're so obsessed with Bibiana. Why insist on marriage when she's clearly not that hot for it?" I held my breath, but he didn't seem to take offense.
She can't mess with me. No way. People who screw with my head have to learn they can't. She hasn't got the word yet.
About what? You have her back. What else do you want?
I have to make sure she stays.
How can you do that?
I did already, he said. She just doesn't know it yet.
Chapter 19. That afternoon at the Southern California College of Auto Fraud, I took a crash course in Swoop and Squat, which Lieutenants Dolan and Santos had summarized so neatly in our little jailhouse chat. We drove up into West L.A. on the border of Bel Air, running Sunset Boulevard from Sepulveda to Beverly Glen. Afternoon traffic was hellish, and the drivers familiar with that stretch of road seemed to drive with their eyes shut, shifting lanes without notice, exceeding the speed limit by 30 and 40 miles per hour. Once we found a mark, Raymond and I, as the squat car, would position ourselves in front of it while Luis and Bibiana would pull up beside us. Luis would swoop suddenly into our lane. Raymond would slam on the brakes, and the hapless mark behind us, caught by surprise, would plow right up our tailpipe. Luis would speed off while Raymond and I in our car, and the mark in his, would pull over to the curb, all of us dismayed and outraged by the unexpected turn of events. There was no danger of the marks turning around and calling the cops, because we all knew the LAPD wouldn't respond to the scene of an accident unless there was bodily injury involved. It was strictly up to us to exchange names, addresses, telephone numbers, and the names of our various insurance companies, after which we'd take off, connect up with Luis and Bibiana again, and go looking for the next Vic. We ran the scam four times, with Raymond assuring me we'd racked up maybe $13,000 worth of business. What troubled me, aside from the fact that I was whipping the hell out of my neck, was a worrisome little shift in my attitude. What idiots, I thought. People deserve anything that happens to them. I was beginning to believe it was all the mark's fault for being gullible and stupid, for not recognizing the game in progress, for being foolish enough to take our assurances at face value. I could feel that secret sense of superiority every con artist must have when the bait goes down and the victim snaps it up. Mentally, I had to shake myself off, though I suppose it never hurts to be reminded that none of us are that far away from larceny. Actually, it's the people who make the most righteous moral noises that I worry about the most. We packed it in at 5 after a quick conference in a little pocket park where we'd pulled off to compare notes. Several nannies in uniform murmured together while the toddlers in their keeping cavorted on the play equipment. We sat on the grass, Bibiana with her shoes off, while Luis and Raymond stretched out in the fading sunlight and relived every thrilling moment. It was like hearing men talk about a golf game or a hunting trip, the two of them rehashing the experience in amazing detail. There was a quick debate about whether to try one more quick accident, but none of us were really interested. All I wanted was some aspirin and a trip back to Dr. Howard's office, where I could look forward to a back cracking that would liberate my neck. Raymond said he had an errand to run, so he and I got back in the car. Luis peeled off in the caddy with Bibiana, while Raymond turned onto Beverly Drive and headed into the heart of the Beverly Hills business district. Two blocks down, he took a ride on Little Santa Monica, which runs parallel to Santa Monica Boulevard. As we approached Wilshire Boulevard, he slowed, looking for a parking space. The meters had all been taken. With an expression of impatience, he turned into the entrance to an underground parking garage that serviced a 20-story office building. We paused at the electronic kiosk, which buzzed, clunked once, and presented him with a ticket. The electronic arm shot up, and Raymond slid into the nearest parking spot, clearly marked for the handicapped. He left the keys in the ignition and opened the door on his side.
"Wait here. Somebody hassles you, move the car. I'll be right back."
A vertical sign on the wall indicated that the elevators were located through the double glass doors. He walked rapidly in that direction, heels tapping on the concrete, the sound echoing against the ramp sweeping up to the left. What was he up to?
The minute he was gone, I took the keys out of the ignition and slipped around to the rear of the car, where I opened the trunk. It was empty except for the spare tire and jack. Rats. I slid into the front seat again and returned the keys to the ignition. I leaned over and checked the door pocket on Raymond's side of the car, but all I came up with were a torn Los Angeles street map and some discount coupons for a local pizza joint. The pocket on my side of the car was empty, which I knew because I'd checked it slyly while we were driving around. I popped open the glove compartment, crammed with junk. I began to sort through the wad of old gas receipts, defective ballpoint pens, successive years of car registrations, the service manual, work orders from the mechanic who did the routine maintenance. Raymond was conscientious about upkeep. I had to give him that. At regular 30-second intervals, I checked the underground reception area where I'd seen him disappear. I was assuming he'd gone up in the elevators to one of the executive offices above. I sorted through the mess of papers in my lap, uncovering rags, a beer flip, a moldy Hershey's bar suffering from heat prostration, a foil-wrapped condom. Did we once keep our gloves in our automobile glove compartments? Now the space seemed to rank right up there with the refrigerator as a resting place for animate and inanimate debris, evidence of a lack of personal cleanliness you'd just as soon your friends never found out about. I returned the odds and ends to the glove compartment, being careful not to be too tidy about it. Frustrating. I'd hoped to come up with something. Oh well, with snooping you can't expect to score every time out. An illegal search might net results in 4 cases out of 10. The rest of the time, it simply satisfies your basic nosiness. By the time I heard Raymond's heels tap-tapping against the concrete, everything was back in place and I was ratting my hair in the rearview mirror, which I'd swiveled around to face me. This Hannah Moore persona was having a distinct effect. My do now consisted of some really nifty spikes on top. I looked like a punker, but it was kind of fun, if you want to know the truth. Next thing I knew, I'd be getting my ears pierced and chewing gum in public. Social sins my auntie had always warned me about, along with red nail polish and dingy bra straps. Raymond opened the car door and tossed the automated parking ticket on the dashboard while he shrugged out of his jacket and tucked it in the back seat. I picked up the ticket and held on to it for him, taking advantage of my little helping girl impulse to glance down at it casually. On the back, in lieu of parking validation stickers, there was the stamped imprint from the firm of Gottlieb, Naples, Hurley, and Flushing. Attorneys? Accountants? Raymond whipped the ticket out of my hand and stuck it in his mouth, clamping it between his teeth while he started the car and backed out of the space. What was his problem? Gosh, the man just didn't seem to trust me. As we turned left out of the parking garage, I silently repeated the name of the firm, like a mantra, until I'd committed it to memory. I'd have Dolan check it out if I could get a call through to him. We drove back to the apartment through rush hour traffic. 6 lanes of the Indy 500, featuring business execs and other control freaks. I was tense, but Raymond didn't seem affected. External stresses didn't seem to disturb him the same way emotional matters did. He flipped the radio on to a classical station and turned the volume up, treating the cars on either side of us to a sonata that sounded like it was made up almost entirely of mistakes. This stretch of the 405 was flat, a sprawling expanse of concrete riddled with factories, dotted with oil derricks, power lines, and industrial structures designed for no known purpose. In the distance, an irregular fence of chimneys was silhouetted against the skyline, which had browned down to an eerie sunset of green and orange light. It was after 7 o'clock, and fully dark by the time we pulled into a parking space out in front of the apartment building. Walking up to the second floor, I was struck by the sounds of apartment life. As usual, many front doors stood open, televisions blaring. Children were running along the balconies, engrossed in a game of their own devising. A mother leaned over the railing and yelled at a kid named Eduardo, who looked to be about 3 years old. He was protesting in Spanish, probably complaining about the indignity of an early bedtime. Luis took the dog and went home soon after we got to the apartment. He'd been babysitting Bibiana, making sure she didn't bolt the minute Raymond's back was turned. The television set was on, tuned to a cable rerun of Leave It to Beaver, which Bibiana watched half-heartedly while she laid out another hand of solitaire. Nobody seemed to feel like fixing dinner, since we'd all spent a hard day smashing up cars and cheating California motorists. Bibiana's depression was exacerbated by cramps, and she went off to bed with a hot water bottle. Raymond conjured up the telephone from its latest hiding place and sent out for Chinese. His tics were back, though they'd ceased to bother me. The guy's personal problems were much larger than the Tourette's, which I suspect other people probably learned to cope with pretty well. His sociopathology was a different matter altogether. While the two of us sat at the kitchen table waiting for the guy to deliver the order, Raymond rolled and smoked a joint. I picked up a couple of the half-completed insurance forms I'd seen earlier. Time to make myself useful, I thought. I looked from the first form to the second. "What's this?" I said, a laugh bubbling up again. I can't help it. Some spelling errors tickle me. "Suffering from a bad case of bruises?" I reached for a third form. Raymond snatched the papers away from me. "Raymond, come on. What's the matter with you? You can't send that to an insurance company. Both of those claims say exactly the same thing." I went ahead and pulled a third claim form from the pile. "Here's another one. Same date, same time. Don't you think they check this stuff? They're going to pick up on that. Here, look. If you want to have those guys fill out the forms, at least use a little imagination. Set up a few different stories."
"I was going to do that," he said with irritation.
"Let me have a turn. It'd be fun," I said. At first, I didn't think he'd do it, but his gaze had settled on my face, and I could see I'd piqued his interest. Reluctantly, he relinquished the form we'd been wrestling over. I picked up a pencil stub and began to print out the narrative for an auto accident.
"Don't make it sound too smart," Raymond said.
"Trust me." I proceeded to invent, off the top of my head, several variations of the accidents I'd participated in that afternoon. I had to pat myself on the back. I was really good at this. I'd make a fortune if I ever turned my hand to crime in earnest. Raymond apparently thought so, too.
"How you know all this stuff?"
"I'm a person of many talents," I said, licking my pencil point. "Quit peeking. You make me nervous." Raymond got us both a cold beer, and we chatted while I wrote up fictional fender benders and minor wrecks. Raymond hadn't managed to graduate from high school, whereas I attended three whole semesters of junior college before I lost heart.
"Why'd you quit, though? You're smart."
"I never liked school," I said. "High school, I was smoking too much dope to do well. College just seemed to be made up of all this stuff I didn't like. I was too rebellious back then, and it's not like I had a career goal in mind. I couldn't see the point in learning things I didn't want to know. Poli-sci and biology? Who needs it? I don't give a damn about xylem and phloem."
"Me neither. Especially phloem, right?"
"Yeah, right," I said, laughing on the assumption he was making a joke. He smiled at me rather sweetly.
"I wish Bibiana were more like you," he said.
"Forget it. I'm a mess. Divorced twice. I'm not any better at relationships than she is." He cleared his throat.
"You know, in my experience, women are no fucking good. The average woman will take you for everything you got. Then, you know what they do? They leave your ass and walk off. I don't get it. What did I ever do?"
"I don't know what to tell you, Raymond. Guys have left me, and that doesn't make 'em bad. That's just the way life goes."
"They break your heart?"
"One or two."
"Well, now, see, that's the difference. You get your heart broke like I do, it's hard to trust, you know that?"
He stared at his beer bottle, peeling a strip of the label with his thumbnail. I felt myself go still, and I chose my words with care. "I'll tell you what somebody told me once. You can't make anyone love you, and you can't keep anyone from dying." He stared at me, his dark eyes nearly luminous. There was a silence while he digested that. He shook his head.
Here's what I say. Somebody don't love me, they die.
At 8:45, our dinner arrived in 6 white cartons, complete with tiny flat plastic pillows of soy sauce and Chinese mustard strong enough to cause a nosebleed. I forked up my food with the voracious appetite generated by secondhand marijuana smoke, which was probably fortunate under the circumstances, as the dishes themselves seemed remarkably similar. All of them were tossed together in a flurry of bok choy and bamboo shoots, one smothered in a sauce that looked like orange crush thickened with cornstarch. Both Raymond and I made little snuffling noises as we ate, polishing off everything except a golf ball-sized clot of steamed rice. The strip of paper in my fortune cookie read, "Your sunny disposition brightens everything around you." Raymond's read, "No two roads ever look alike." Which made no sense whatever. He seemed to think it was profound, but by then the whites of his eyes had turned pink and he'd started eating a dope-inspired snack that he had devised, grape jelly scooped up with stale corn chips. I went to bed, but before I turned off the light, I took out the stolen bridal photo and took one more look. Who was this woman? I knew it would come to me. Her identity might also turn out to be unrelated to the investigation, but I didn't think so. I settled down for the night on my lumpy couch. I longed to be at home in the safety of my own bed. I could feel anxiety whisper at the base of my spine. There was an ancient, familiar physical sensation I couldn't at first identify. Some piece of my childhood being stirred up by circumstance. I felt a squeezing in my stomach. Not an ache, but some process that was almost like grief. I closed my eyes, longing for sleep, longing for something else, though I couldn't think what. My eyes came open, and in a flash I knew. I was homesick. My aunt had sent me off to summer camp when I was 8, claiming that it would be good for me to get away. I see now maybe she was the one who needed the relief. She told me I'd have a wonderful time and meet lots of girls my own age. She said we'd swim and ride horses and go on nature walks and sing songs around the campfire at night. In dizzying detail, memories passed across my mental screen. It was true about the girls and all the activities. What was also true was that after half a day, I didn't want to be there. The horses were big and covered with flies, hot straw baseballs coming out their butts at intervals. Their muzzles were as soft and silky as suede with little prickles embedded in it, but when you least expected it, they would whip their heads up quick and try to bite you with teeth the size of piano keys. Nature turned out to be straight uphill, dusty and hot and itchy. The part that wasn't dry and tiresome was even worse. We were supposed to swim in a lake with an Indian name, but the bottom was vile and squishy. Half the time I worried there'd be broken bottles buried in the ooze. One false step, and I knew my tender instep would be slashed to the bone. When I wasn't worried about slime and sharp rocks, I worried about the creatures gliding through the murky depths, tentacles trailing languidly toward my pale, skinny legs. The first night around the campfire, after we sang Kumbaya about 6 times, they told me about this poor girl camper who had drowned 2 years before, and one who'd had an allergic reaction to a bee sting and nearly died, and another who broke her arm falling out of a tree. Also, one of the girl counselors had been parked with her boyfriend necking when the radio announcer told about this escaped raving maniac, and after they rolled the car window up and drove away quick, there was his hook right in the window. That night I cried myself to sleep, weeping in utter silence, so as not to disgrace myself. In the morning I discovered that I had all the wrong kind of shorts, and I was forced to endure a lot of pitying looks because mine had elastic around the waist. At breakfast the scrambled eggs were flabby and had white parts this girl in my cabin said were made out of unborn baby bird. After I was sick and got sent to the infirmary, there was a 12-year-old girl who was bleeding, but they said wasn't really hurt. It was just a dead baby coming out of her bottom every month. At lunch, there was carrot salad with dark spots. The next day, I went home. which is where I wanted to be now. I slept poorly. Chapter 20. Early the next morning, the Santa Teresa cops called to say Chago's autopsy had been completed. Raymond went off to the funeral home to make arrangements to have the body brought down. The funeral director had apparently assured him by phone that he could have Chago ready for viewing that evening. Rosary would be recited Sunday evening at the funeral chapel. A mass would be said at 10 a.m., Monday morning at Blessed Redemption, with interment following at Roosevelt Memorial Park in Gardena. When Raymond got back, he conferred with Luis, who left soon afterward with the dog. Word was apparently out on the street. The same two girls I'd seen the first day showed up and sat down at the kitchen table, where they began putting together paper booklets with a stapler and some colored marker pens. I could see R.I.P. Chago in ornate Gothic letters on the front. A stack of Xeroxed photographs were being collated with printed matter. Within an hour, Chago's old homies began to arrive in twos and threes, some accompanied by wives or girlfriends. Most of them seemed too old to be active gang members at this point. Drugs, cigarettes, and booze had taken their toll, leaving bloated bellies and bad coloring. These were the survivors of God knows what turf wars, guys in their late 20s who probably considered themselves fortunate to be alive. The mood of the gathering was one of muted uneasiness, a community of mourners assembling to honor a fallen comrade. All I'd known of Chago was his last inching journey toward a Santa Teresa street corner. In the rain and the darkness, he'd set his failing sights, hunching toward home. I saw no sign of Juan or Ricardo, Raymond's two remaining brothers, but Bibiana assured me they'd be at the funeral home later. I gathered visiting hours would extend through the evening, and both of us would have to be there. In the meantime, I was feeling awkward. I hadn't known Raymond's brother and didn't know any of the people who'd come to pay their respects. I was looking for the opportunity to excuse myself discreetly and retire to my room. There was a little flurry by the front door, and the priest arrived in clerical black, a hyphen of snowy white collar visible at his neck. Bibiana leaned close and murmured, "Father Luevanos. He's the parish priest." Father Luevanos was in his 60s, a spare man with a withered face and a frizzy cloud of white hair. He was small and trim, shoulders narrow, his hands long and thin. He seemed to hold them away from his body, palms facing outward like St. Francis of Assisi, only minus the birds. He moved through the crowd, talking softly to each of his parishioners. He was treated like royalty, people parting to let him through. Raymond crossed to his side. Father Luevanos took his hands, and the two murmured together in a mixture of English and Spanish. I could see Raymond's grief surface in response to the priest's compassion. He didn't weep, but his face underwent a curious series of ticks that, from a distance, looked like the fast-forward sequence of a man in tears. I gathered Chago had been one of Raymond's anchors, perhaps the only family member who really loved Raymond and was loved in return. Raymond caught my eye. He beckoned me over and introduced me to the priest.
"She's from Santa Teresa."
Father Luevanos held on to my hands while we talked.
"Nice to meet you. You have a lovely community in Santa Teresa. How long have you known Valenzuelo?"
"Who?"
"Chago," Raymond murmured.
"Oh," I could feel my cheeks color. "Actually, I'm a friend of Bibiana's."
"I see."
As if on cue, Bibiana moved forward to greet the priest. She had changed into a black skirt, a white blouse, and black spike heels. She had tucked a red satin rose in her hair. Her face was very pale, makeup looking stark against the pallor of her cheeks.
"Father," she whispered.
She was close to tears, and her mouth began to tremble when he took her hands. He leaned toward her, murmuring something in Spanish. She must have felt an almost overwhelming impulse to unburden herself. Once Father Luevanos had departed, the mood of the place began to lighten. The afternoon had a lazy feel to it, despite the occasion. The front door stood open, and the crowd spilled out onto the balcony. Some of the guys had brought six-packs, chips, and salsa. Conversations were punctuated by the hiss of pop-tops. There was muted laughter and cigarette smoke. Somebody brought a steel-string guitar and picked out intricate melodies. A 9-month-old baby named Ignacio toddled 5 steps and then sank down on his diapered behind, thoroughly satisfied with the applause his journey had netted him. At 5:30, the crowd began to thin. We were expected over at the funeral home early, so Raymond could view the body before the others arrived. We headed out for the funeral home at 6. Bibiana and I sat together in the back seat. Luis drove. Raymond sat in the passenger seat, silent and distraught, clutching a bundle he'd carried out of the bedroom with him, wrapped loosely in the folds of a white satin scarf. His emotional distress had set off a whole galaxy of symptoms, jerks and twitches that seemed all the more wrenching for the look on his face. In the space of an hour, he'd gone from a vicious hoodlum to a scared-looking kid, overwhelmed by the ordeal that lay ahead of him. The funeral home was housed in an extravagant Victorian mansion, one of the rare remaining structures from the early grandeur of Los Angeles.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
The funeral home was housed in an extravagant Victorian mansion, one of the rare remaining structures from the early grandeur of Los Angeles. The one-time single-family residence was 3 stories tall, the roof line broken up by towers and chimneys. The face of it was smoke-darkened stone and brown shingle, ancient tattered palms and cedars overpowering the lot, which was flanked on either side by squat concrete office buildings. The facade jarred my sense of reality, placing me for a split second in the year 1887, past and future trading places briefly. The interior was a cavernous collection of hushed rooms with high ceilings, dark varnished woodwork, textured wallpaper, and indirect lighting. The muted chords of an organ were barely audible, creating a subliminal mood of sorrow and solemnity. The furniture was Victorian, damask and ornately carved wood, except for the metal folding chairs that had been arranged around the parlor where Chago had been laid out. The pearly gray coffin rested in a bay at the far end of the room, half lid open to reveal a white satin interior and a portion of his profile. The bier was surrounded by big sprays of white gladioli and wreaths of white carnations, white rosebuds, baby's breath. Raymond had apparently spared no expense. Luis, Bibiana, and I lingered discreetly near the entranceway while Raymond approached the coffin, bearing his bundle like an offering. I gathered this was the first time he'd seen Chago since his death on Tuesday night. He bowed his head, staring into the coffin, his expression not visible from where we stood. After a moment, he crossed himself. I saw him unfold the white satin scarf and lean close to Chago's body, but it was hard to tell what he was doing. Moments later, he backed away from the coffin and crossed himself again. He took out a handkerchief and blew his nose. He mopped at his eyes and tucked the handkerchief away, then turned and walked the length of the room in our direction. When he reached us, Luis put out a hand and clasped him by the shoulder, giving him a consoling pat.
"Hey, man, it's rough," he said, his voice barely audible.
Bibiana moved away from us. She approached the coffin reluctantly, her apprehension apparent. She looked at the body briefly, then crossed herself. She went over and took a seat, fumbling in her handbag for a Kleenex.
"You want to see him?" Raymond asked.
His eyes were clouded by a pleading impossible to resist. It seemed like an intimate moment, observing the dead, and since I hadn't known the man, it seemed inappropriate that I join his friends and family at the head of his coffin. On the other hand, it seemed insulting to refuse. Raymond picked up on my indecision, smiling sweetly.
"No, come on. It's okay. He looks good."
That was a matter of opinion, of course. I'd actually seen Chago twice. Once on Tuesday at the CF offices when he bumped into me in the hall, and again that night at the Bourbon Street restaurant when he'd abducted Bibiana at gunpoint. He'd seemed like a big man then, but death had pressed him flat. He looked like a Ken doll on display in an oversized carrying case. He was probably 4 or 5 years younger than Raymond, with the same good looks. His face was smooth and unlined, chin and cheekbones prominent. His hair had been blown into a dark, glossy pompadour that made his head seem too large for the width of his shoulders. Raymond's satin-wrapped packet had apparently contained religious items. An oversized Bible, bound in textured white, had been clumsily propped up against the chalky pink of Chago's folded hands. A rosary had been laid across his fingers, and a framed photograph of him as a small boy placed on the small white pillow on which he lay. The pillow was satin and looked like the sort women use when they don't want to mess up an expensive salon hairdo. Luis and I studied Chago as attentively as one watches an infant in the company of a proud parent. At 7, some of the homeboys I'd seen at the apartment began to arrive. They seemed ill at ease in Raymond's presence, unaccustomed to seeing him in a sport coat and tie. Chago's buddies had all donned specially made-up black T-shirts with "In Loving Memory of Chago, R.I.P. on the back and their own names on the front. I sat down beside Bibiana, the two of us saying little. Occasionally, someone would make eye contact, but no one talked to me. Most of the conversations taking place around me were in Spanish anyway, so I couldn't even eavesdrop decently. The crowd was swelling. There was no sign of either of Raymond's brothers, but I did see three women I took to be his older sisters. They seemed remarkably similar, with their large dark eyes, full mouths, perfect skin. They sat in a cluster, beautiful women in their 40s, heavy and dark, looking like nuns with their black mantillas and their rosaries. They would exchange occasional comments, but not a word to Raymond, who was making an elaborate show of not giving a damn. In an unguarded moment, I saw him flick a look in their direction. I understood then that Bibiana was just another version of his sister's, exquisite and rejecting, just as his mother must have been. Poor Raymond. No matter how many versions of the story he managed to create, he would never win her love, and he'd never make it come out happily. A cluster of three mourners approached Bibiana. Chicanas in their 20s, one with a baby on her hip. I got up and eased toward the door, wondering if there was any way I could get to a telephone. Before I reached the doorway, Luis appeared at my side and took my arm. I leaned close. "Do you think there's a ladies' room upstairs?"
"You're not going anywhere."
"Oh, well, I guess it doesn't matter then if there's one upstairs."